everybody. Welcome to another episode of the amazing podcast about interesting dead people, Dirt Nap City. I am one of your two hosts, Kelly, and I'm here with my buddy, Alex. How you doing, Alex?
Hey, man. Right out the gate with amazing. That's nice.
This is one of the things I actually truly enjoy doing here in 2024, is recording podcasts with you. It hasn't gotten old yet, but the shine is still there. What would you say?
Yeah, and I don't think modesty helps anybody.
And you know, unlike people like Siskel and Ebert, we actually do get along behind the scenes and don't try to pull all this passive-aggressive stuff on one another.
Sure. Siegfried and Roy, Siskel and Ebert.
Shields and Yarnell.
Yeah, you always threaten to do Siegfried and Roy as one of the episodes one of these days.
I thought, actually, when you did Siskel and Ebert, I kind of thought that maybe was who it was going to be, was Shields and Yarnell first, Siegfried and Roy.
I'll just tell you right now, I'm never going to do Siegfried and Roy. So that lane is clear for you.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Are you ever going to do Shields and Yarnell?
I might.
Yeah.
I bet less than five people listening know who Shields and Yarnell are.
Well, GTS, everybody. Google that stuff. Today, I have kind of taken my big Edsel, or my big 57 Chevy, and swerved way over into your lane.
Mm.
A man of the 20th century.
Ooh.
He was actually born in Houston, Texas, and died near Houston, Texas. He was one of the most famed people of the 20th century, probably back until about the 70s or 80s, but still has a big influence today. He was given a rare opportunity because his father had invented something that made a lot of money, but he didn't necessarily follow in his father's footsteps. He went a totally different direction, but he didn't just sit around with his father's money when his father died. He took it to made it his own and really pioneered a couple of different industries and became well known as a business person who was supposed to be, you know, have the Midas touch.
Is this person known as a Texan?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, no, that's not really his identity. You know, he wasn't like a big cowboy hat wearing guy or anything like that. But I think most people knew he was from Texas.
You said started a couple of different industries, not just companies.
No, didn't start. Started in a couple of different industries, established industries. As a matter of fact, the industries he was most passionate about were pretty sexy. They were things that people actually really liked. Like one of them was movie making.
Okay. Are you talking about Howard Hughes?
I am. Wow. Well done.
It's funny because I think off the air, we were talking about how interesting recluses might be.
Yes. Yeah. When you said that, I had to kind of bite my tongue because he was a recluse.
And that is the tricky thing, because we're talking about interesting dead people. Of course, Howard Hughes was an interesting person, but he often went weeks or months without doing anything, right? Later in life.
Oh, yes. But still, there was so much going on. Sure. So much going on, even when he was a recluse. He actually tried to run his company, not just his company, because he was in so many different things, from that recluseness. He had telephones. He had an entire staff with operations that would, give him messages, put phone calls through, get people on the phone for him. He had lieutenants. He was almost like, you know, when you hear about someone in prison calling on a hit and getting someone killed outside of prison, you're like, how do they do that? They're in prison. Mm. It was almost like that. He could make things happen outside of his four walls, even though for months and years he was a recluse and didn't see anybody, didn't shower, didn't cut his nails or his hair, didn't wear clothes a lot of the time. I mean, he was a strange cat.
Well, I can't wait to hear about this. But you know, you say this is my lane. I think this is very much your lane. I think the people that I've learned that you are interested in are these kind of big, these titans, these big titans of industry, these people that have big ideas, the people that are powerful and run a lot of stuff and a little quirky. So I think this fits right in your lane. Maybe in my century.
Yeah, that was what I was referencing. Moore was just a man of the 20th century. Because he was born, he was actually born in 1905 and died in 1976. Wow. So born actually on Christmas Eve, 1905, in Houston, Texas. Died in 1976 on an airplane, actually. Passed away on the way to a hospital in Houston. But there's some debate whether he made it or not. His father was also named Howard Hughes. Now, Howard Hughes Jr., the one we're talking about, his middle name, do you know his middle name?
No, is Vivian?
Robard.
Okay, I was close.
R-O-B-A-R-D. And a lot of times people refer to him as HRH. A lot of his staff refer to him as HRH. So Howard Robard Hughes Jr. was the only child of Elena Stone Gano and Howard R. Hughes Sr., who were from Missouri originally, but moved to Houston. And Howard Hughes Sr. actually invented the two-cone roller drill bit in 1909. Now, can you imagine what that is? You've seen pictures of this thing. It's like these two cones with little teeth on them that are at an angle, and they kind of run together, and then they made them with three cones. That was big innovation back then, because when the oil boom happened, there were a lot of places where they couldn't get to the oil because sand would clog up the bits or the rock was too tough to get through. Well, when Howard Hughes Sr. invented this thing, it was immediately a hit, immediately allowed them to drill in places they couldn't before. And he had the good sense, the sort of insight to patent it and not sell it, but rent it, lease it to people.
That when money keeps coming in.
Pretty much everyone in the drilling industry, and we've talked about oil barons, you know, back there, and Rockefeller being one of them, they had to rent this thing from the Hughes Tool Company. He was actually very good at tinkering with mechanical devices. And as a matter of fact, at the age of 11, he built a wireless radio transmitter. He was one of the first licensed ham radio operators in Houston, and his call sign was W5CY, which I have no idea what that means, but that was his call sign. At the age of 12, he actually was photographed and put into the newspaper, and because he had built a motorized bicycle, he had taken a steam engine and attached it to a bicycle and, you know, early electric bike, early e-bike.
That's cool,
I guess. And then when he was 14, he started taking flying lessons. He just fell in love with aviation and started taking flying lessons. But, you know, his childhood, despite having money and parents that cared about him, he actually was kind of done a disservice by his mother, at least according to the biography. She gave him a lot of attention when he was sick. And he learned to kind of hide in sickness as a way to get attention and to even, I don't want to say fake sickness, but, you know, kind of like play up his ailments in order to get attention from his mother, which later translated into other things.
So he did this to get attention, not to get out of school necessarily, not Ferris Bueller style, but just because he knew that that would get him attention.
Probably a little bit of both, right? He like, okay, I can either go to school or I can stay home and have my mother give me ice cream, you know? And he did love ice cream. He loved milk and ice cream. He was a big fan of both those things. He was also big on golf, and he had to give up golf later in life because he kept crashing airplanes and like got pretty like physically messed up. And he also was a big germaphobe. And even at a young age, he was a little bit of one. And I think there was some phobias in his family, like fear of bugs, fear of germs. And by bugs, I mean insects. But it got worse as he got older. I mean, that was actually part of his being a recluse, was because of his fear of germs in the outside world. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, his mother died in 1922. And his father died 2 years later in 24, actually in a conference room at his company. His father was having a board meeting or a, you know, a company meeting, and he keeled over from a heart attack in 24. Well, because of the way, actually the will had been written, originally to go, everything to go to the mother. Well, because she had died 2 years earlier, it all ended up going to Howard Hughes. Basically, he inherited 75% of the family fortune at the age of 18 or 19, and then got himself declared an emancipated minor, which meant that he didn't have to have a guardian, because a lot of times with that much money, you had to have a trustee or a guardian until you were 21. Well, he was able to go to court and get a judge to declare him an adult. And then he took his money and bought out his other family members that still had some of the family fortune. Like, he had inherited 75% of it, and he bought out the remaining 25% from family members.
And that was millions, right?
Oh, yeah. Millions of dollars. The Hughes Tool Company, again, was just gangbusters with this tool bit, this drill bit that they had. And it just, you know, they kept coming up with things for oil and drilling and technology and tools and stuff like that. They became very specialized. And basically that was the way that he was able to bankroll his other passions, was because this company was so successful, he could take the money from that and pour it into other things. But he was never very involved. He was never really involved at all in the Hughes Tool Company until later in life. At a young age, he actually withdrew from Rice University, where he had been attending in Houston after his father's death. And then on June 1st, he married Ella Botts Rice. And she's the daughter of David Rice and Martha Lawson Botts of Houston, and the niece of William Marsh Rice, for whom Rice University is named.
So he dropped out of Rice and then married a Rice.
Yeah.
There you go.
They moved to Los Angeles, he and Ella Botts Rice, and he was going to be a filmmaker. That's what he wanted to do. And that was a little bit telling of his personality. You know, even though he was shy, and later in life he was a recluse, he also liked people to look up to him. He looked for admiration. He looked for validation from what people thought about him. And making movies, if you think about it, it's a really sexy career, right? To be a movie producer or director. Flying airplanes, very sexy career, you know, pilot. Real estate, gambling, you know, all these things he was into later in life, all stuff that really made him look like a sort of big man in the U.S. And that's what he liked.
So when you say he wanted to be a movie maker, do you mean to finance, or do you mean on the creative side, he wanted to like direct or write movies?
All of the above, except the writing part. So he actually, his first movie that he was involved in when he was in L.A. with his new wife, Ella, first of all, they moved into the Ambassador Hotel. He spent a lot of time living in hotels. Like, that was kind of his jam, was to rent out the penthouse or the entire top floor. And they moved to LA, lived in the Ambassador Hotel. And at that time, he continued to take flying lessons, and he started working on his first film. It's not known whether or not he, you know, to your question about whether he directed and wrote or just put the money up, there's some debate about this film, whether he directed it or whether he just put the money up. But it was written, and it starred a man named Ralph Graves. And it was called Swell Hogan. It was made in 1926, and it's a sentimental comedy about a Bowery bum who helps orphans.
I'm in.
Yes. Yes, a sentimental comedy. I mean,
is this a talking picture? Yeah. Is this a talking?
No, silent.
Silent.
Sure. Silent movies. He started in silent. What happened is this guy, Ralph Graves, who was the star and the writer, persuaded Hughes to put up $40,000. Well, it ended up taking $80,000 to make the movie. And when it was finished, Hughes screened it several times, realized it was really a disaster, and actually showed it to his uncle. I forgot to mention this. His father's brother, Rupert Hughes, was a film director and screenwriter and lived in Hollywood. And that might've been his inspiration, but he showed it to his uncle, who confirmed it was terrible.
I bet he did.
It's actually rumored that Howard Hughes had all of the film destroyed. So I don't think you'll be able to find Swell Hogan on the internet.
And I'll bet the bar wasn't super high to be a good movie back then either. I mean, this is the early day of movies. They were
1926.
Silent. I mean, it probably wasn't that hard to make a decent movie.
If you could play the piano, you know, the sort of Joplin style piano, then you were good.
And for a family member to tell you that it sucked, it must have really been bad.
Yeah, but you know, one of the key takeaways from that is the budget that he originally had doubled. So, you know, like I said, instead of $40,000, he spent $80,000. And this was a reoccurring thing that happened throughout his life. He ended up not being the businessman everybody thought he was because he didn't really care about profits. He had this fountain of money coming from the Hughes Tool Company. And so he would throw money at things without care for whether they actually returned a profit or not. It was more about what the public perceived as success versus real success.
Tell me more about that. That's an interesting thing you just said.
He also had a big phobia and resentment for taxes. And one of the interesting things, the entire time he was in California, so he moved away from Houston when he was like 19, 20 years old, and basically lived most of the rest of his life in California, briefly in Las Vegas, and then a bit in Latin America later in life. He still always claimed to live in Texas. You know why? Taxes.
Right.
He didn't want to pay state income tax. He didn't want to pay, he basically claimed to be a Texan, but rarely came back to Houston. Really didn't want to come back to Houston, but he did claim to be a Texan.
Mm. So when you say he would throw money at things, even if they weren't worth it, is that like buying Twitter for $44 billion? And is there any?
Probably. I think there's definitely some parallels between him and several rich guys that are famous today. Mm. So as he continued, let me give you another example. He made a couple of more films and actually did pretty well with these. One was called Everybody's Acting. It was done in 1926. One was called Two Arabian Nights, 1927. Both of those were financially successful, made some money. And Two Arabian Nights actually won the Academy Award for Best Director of a Comedy, which was a big deal. In 1928, he did one called The Racket. And in 1931, he did one called The Front Page. And those were also nominated, but didn't win Academy Awards. So had a fair amount of success in Hollywood as a director. Unfortunately, his wife wasn't digging it. He didn't spend a lot of time with her. He was out on shoots all the time and, you know, supposedly carousing with starlets and such. And so she moved back to Houston in 1929 and filed for divorce.
Yeah.
But asking about throwing money at things. So in 1930, there was a movie he made called Hell's Angels, and it was a World War I airplane film. Had blimps, biplanes. I think they used like almost 100 airplanes in this film. There were cases where airplanes crashed, and actually I think at least one person was killed. One pilot was killed during the making of this. Howard Hughes himself was in an airplane and might have been running the camera. He was a very hands-on guy, by the way. Like when he did movies, he directed, he ran the camera, he just wanted to do everything. When he did aviation, he test flew all of his own planes. Like he didn't let other people do that. He wanted to do it. He said, "Why should I pay someone else to have all the fun?" Well, during this film, several planes crashed, including one that he was in, and he that was his first plane crash, went down fairly easily in a field, like a farmer's field. And so he walked away from that, but he ended up spending $3.5 million, which, you know, as I said before, the other movie, Swell Hogan, he ended up spending $80,000, which was double the budget. This was $3.5 million. And part of the reason this went over so big, over budget so much, besides all the airplanes, a couple of reasons. Number one, shot a bunch of scenes where he wasn't happy with how the scenes looked because the planes looked like they were going slow. Well, the reason they look like they're going slow is because there's no point of reference to show anything behind them, right? You're panning the camera. It's a blue sky. It almost looks like the plane's standing still if you keep the camera in the center of the frame. He reshot those scenes with clouds. So he basically had to move the entire production to another place in California where there were clouds, wait several days for the right amount of puffy clouds, the right weather, and reshoot. Well, every day you're not filming, you're paying for the all the airplanes, all the pilots, all the extras, you know, everything. And so there was that. But then what really jacked up the budget on that was right when talkies started being big, sound in the movies. And he realized when the thing was finally put together, because it took several years for them to put it together, he realized that he had missed the boat. It was a silent movie when the next big thing was people talking in movies. So he actually paid to reshoot all the dialogue scenes and add sound effects and made it into a talkie, but had to reshoot everything where people were talking.
Wow. See, this is what rich people do, though. They're not constrained by anything. So they can just make these decisions, and sometimes they pay off and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you're doubling the budget of things and not getting the return. They still do this, right? This is what's fascinating.
100% his MO. So that film, Hell's Angels, did receive an Academy Award for the best cinematography, which was, you know, pretty good. I mean, fine doing cinematography in an airplane, doing camera work in an airplane at the time was pretty big deal. And I watched some clips from this movie and it was pretty good.
I mean, this is 90 years ago we're talking, right? I mean, this is a long time ago.
Coming up on 100 pretty soon. So he did a few more films. He did Scarface, the original Scarface, which was about the Chicago ganglands. That film actually got a lot of press and actually ended up being pretty well viewed and made money because there was so much debate about the censorship of it. The censors at the time thought it glorified violence, glorified gangsters, and they ended up making him reshoot and re-edit some scenes and then add a prologue at the beginning condemning gangsters.
We've talked before about the different censor laws that they had back then, what movies were trying to be.
What was it called?
Hayes Act, yeah.
Hayes Act, yeah. So anyway, he directed one called The Outlaw in 1943. It was a Western about Billy the Kid, Doc Holliday, and it had Jane Russell as the leading lady. She played Rio McDonald. Well, so first of all, I'm going to say Howard Hughes knew how to do PR. He was very good at that. So for Scarface, for example, he took advantage of all the press and all the fight he was having with the censors to build intrigue. Well, he did the same thing, except with Jane Russell, he was doing it through low-cut dresses and camera angles to accentuate her.
You know what people wanted to see.
Yeah, I mean, she was a beautiful woman. But he didn't actually like the way some of those shots were looking, and he actually engineered a special bra, one of the first underwire bras. Nobody had done this. He took some metal rods and bent them and had his team affix them to her bra so that they would do the lift and squeeze. And that was his thing, is he wanted to lift and squeeze Jane Russell so that she could look even sexier. Well, that worked. You know, she became a big star. The movie was a big hit. And Jane Russell said later, believe me, he could design airplanes, but Mr. Playtex, he wasn't.
And he probably wouldn't care.
By the way, he was doing movies and airplanes at the same time. So I'm kind of going through the movie stuff now, but we'll talk airplanes in a minute. He dated women like Joan Crawford, Billy Dove, Betty Davis, Ava Gardner, Katherine Hepburn, Ginger Rogers, Gloria Vanderbilt. I mean, Jean Tierney, who I'm not sure who that is, but there was a quote about that Jean Tierney said about like him dating all these women. She said, "I don't think Howard could love anything that didn't have a motor in it." So she kind of was saying why he never fell in love. But yeah, he always had a beautiful starlet on his arm. Sometimes as an actual date, as a romant, romantic interests, sometimes more just, you know, in a professional thing. Like if they were in one of his films, there were several people that said, yeah, it was very platonic. We just went to these things because I was in his film. But he had this way of sending out these contracts to young women who wanted to be stars. He had hundreds over the years of women on his payroll that would go to acting lessons. They would take diction lessons. They would take singing lessons. And he would kind of keep them in reserve if he wanted to make a movie. Now, again, this wasn't a money-making thing. This was just something he did out of vanity, I suppose, probably, you know, to woo some of these women, you know, hey, do you want to be a star kind of thing? But he took it somewhat seriously, but he never used a lot of those women in films. They were just kind of people that he put a contract out on, that he paid them. He gave them these lessons, but they never ended up being in a movie. And again, another sort of really bad business decision, right? Why do you have 50 people on your payroll that you're not even going to ever have in a film?
And in some ways kind of set the tone probably for Hollywood.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's interesting. He came to Hollywood. Hollywood was established, but he later went to Las Vegas and really wanted to set the tone for Las Vegas. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But kind of finishing up on the Hollywood part, he acquired RKO Pictures in 1948. So that was one of the big five studios in Hollywood's golden age. But within weeks of acquiring the studio, he fired 700 employees. He dropped the production schedule. He shut down production for 6 months so that he could order investigations into the political leanings of every employee. He wanted to make sure that they weren't communists or, you know, anything like that. He basically felt like he had to go in and clean house and slow everything down and micromanage a lot of stuff to the point where the company quit making enough movies to be profitable. You know, they had gone from making 30 pictures every year to 9. And in 1957, it actually shut down. RKO struggled and shut down.
Wow. They just went into music at that point, I think, because I think they had a record label after that.
They had movie theaters, they had a record label, they had radio stations, they had a whole bunch of things. And yeah, it may have kind of dwindled down to one thing, but basically it was another one of those losing business ventures that, you know, he acquired the studio.
Sounds like his paranoia was also a part of this whole mix.
Yeah, he felt like he had to micromanage everything. He kind of made movies until 1957. His last movie was one with John Wayne called The Jet Pilot. And he also had an interesting thing he did right after Prohibition. Now, until I started doing this research, I knew Prohibition had happened somewhere in the early 1920s. I wasn't sure of the dates. Do you know the dates for that? Kind of.
Did it last about 4 years?
13 years.
Oh, no kidding.
1920 to 1933.
I think every time I learn this, I'm surprised. And then I learn it again and I'm surprised. Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah. And it is interesting because you think about the roaring 20s, you know, being like everybody drinking and dancing and flappers and
it was all illegal. Huh?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's part of why it was roaring, right? But yeah, at the end of Prohibition in 1933, that's kind of when the Great Depression hit, when things started to get kind of bad. He ended up starting a brewery in Houston on the grounds of the Hughes Tool Company, because they had land in Houston, and it was called Gulf Brewing. Had you heard of that?
No, I've never heard of that.
They had best-selling beer. It was called Grand Prize. He brought in a master brewer from Europe to be the master brewer and ran this thing for a while and then eventually sold it. I don't know if he made money on the deal or not, but I thought it was kind of cool. I actually went online and started looking. You can buy old, they had a pretty cool logo, the Gulf Brewing did. And their Grand Prize logo was kind of cool too. You can buy old t-shirts with the beer logo on it that says Houston, Texas.
It didn't look like the Gulf gas station logo.
No. It was totally different company, but Gulf Brewing.
But that's not around. And that wasn't around when we were coming up.
No. I think it, you know, stopped sometime maybe in the 70s, 60s. I'm not sure. I mean, this was in 1933 when he at the end of Prohibition when he founded it. Mm-hmm. So, but it was a smart, actually a smart business decision because it helped, you know, it was one of those things when the, you know, even during financial depressions, Americans still spend a lot of money on things like alcohol and coffee and, you know, those little small luxuries that aren't super expensive. People still treat themselves to. They might not buy cars or houses, but they'll still buy those smaller sure. things, and especially if it helps them forget their troubles.
We saw that during COVID, right?
Yeah, yeah. In 1957, he remarried to a woman named Jean Peters. She was an actress. They had met in the 40s and had kind of been on again, off again, and it said that Peters was the only woman that Howard Hughes ever loved. But it was kind of a weird marriage because initially when they got married, they lived in the Beverly Hills Hotel and they had separate bungalows for a long time, for several years. Peters eventually said, you're my husband. I want to live with you. And so they started buying houses. They lived in a house together, but even in the house, they lived in separate rooms. And apparently he was becoming more of a germaphobe, more of a recluse at that point. And she wasn't allowed to vacuum in his room because it would stir up dust. So rather than stir up dust, he'd just have dust everywhere. He started doing weird things like storing his own urine in jars so that doctors could look at it if they needed to. But actually Jean Peters stuck with him. She put up with all that stuff. She loved him. Eventually, he ended up moving to Las Vegas and several other places. He left LA and left without her and didn't see her for like 3 years, and then finally saw her, and then that was only brief, and then she moved back. She went back to LA while he was gone, living in Vegas. And after years and years, in 1971, she filed for divorce. So what was that? That was like 14 years they were married. But she never spoke ill of him. You know, Jean Peters was, the love of his life. She never spoke poorly of him. She didn't die until the 90s. She was around for a while. But he just got too weird to live with.
Yeah, I can imagine.
In parallel, during all this time, in 1932, he started formed the Hughes Aircraft Company. And his whole goal was to be able to contract for the government, to be able to build planes for the government, you know, for military, for science, for all these kind of things. And he did end up getting a couple of government contracts. Even later in life, he had a government contract to build helicopters. But every single one of the airplanes he was going to build either had overruns in cost or wasn't done in time for the war. There were problems with all of them. So he loved it. That was his passion. He loved to look at airplane magazines. He loved to, like, anything to do with aviation he was into and had a brain for it. He was very, very smart when it came to that sort of thing. He actually was inducted to the Aviation Hall of Fame in 1973 and was listed in Flying Magazine's 2013 list of heroes of aviation as number 25.
Sure. Wow.
But despite all of his fame in aviation, he actually crashed four different airplane crashes, survived all four.
That's why he was only number 25, I guess.
Yeah, right. He would have been number one, but he went down notches every time he crashed. One was a Thomas Moore Scout that was used when filming Hell's Angels. And that was his first air crash. That was the one I said was in a farmer's field, and actually he walked away from with his
Did he have bruises. A camera? Like, what,
yes.
Was he filming it?
I don't know if he was filming or if he was flying. It seemed more likely that he was probably flying and someone else was filming, but I'm not sure. But
he might have been trying to do both. That's why he crashed.
Right. That's exactly why you shouldn't text and drive, kids. So he then crashed a racing airplane that he had built while trying to set an airspeed record. That one was also in a field and minor deal. He crashed one military plane that he was, Sikorsky, that he was doing touch and goes with at Lake Mead, and actually had a couple of people die in that crash. The plane sunk. It was in the water, had pontoons on it, and he climbed out. And a couple of other, there were like four or five people in the plane at the time, and he and two other people got out, but two of them didn't, or something like that, sunk to the bottom. He actually had the plane excavated from the bottom of Lake Mead. And, you know, that's outside of Las Vegas. That is a deep, big lake.
Oh, yeah.
And then he crashed into a house in Hollywood while he was testing his military plane in 1946. Man. And that one, he got pretty severely injured. Basically, what happened is he had a flight plan, and he was, and this is another case where people asked him, why are you doing the testing? Why are you test flying a plane? And he said, I'm not going to pay someone else to have all the fun. but it's very dangerous. And what happened is the flight plan called for him to fly for like 30 minutes in this thing. It was called the Hughes XF-11, and it was something he had contracted to the government. He was supposed to fly for about 30 minutes in this thing. Well, he ended up going over because he was trying to kind of show off in it and show that it could do more things and going further and basically pushing the boundaries. When these government contracts happened and they had flight testing, they were supposed to only stick to a few things. And then on the next flight, you would do more things. On the next flight, you would do more things. Well, he just skipped right to the end and started doing everything. And he ran out of fuel. He had problems with the landing gear. And one of the motors failed because there was a defect in one of the propellers that caused that engine to lock up. So it was a dual engine plane, two motors, one on each wing, and one of them locked up. And so he was only flying with one thing. So there's a lot of drag in one direction.
Oh my gosh.
He was trying to land on a golf course. It might've been the Beverly Hills golf course or Hollywood golf course, you know, somewhere in LA area. And couldn't make it and actually ran into a house, hit the roof, fell to the ground, was able to climb out of the aircraft, had burns all over his body, and collapsed near the aircraft. And there was a man who actually was there. I think he was a military guy visiting his family who ran out and picked him out of the crash and brought him away from it and kind of saved his life. Like, you know, carried him away so he could get medical attention. Well, that was about the time when all that happened, when he had started taking a lot of pain medications.
And he was already kind of strange to begin with. And you take someone like that and then you add all that cocktail to it. Yeah, it's not going to end well.
Yeah. And that definitely didn't help him in his recluseness. Now, a few other things about aviation from him. He did actually become pretty famous, and you know, he hoped to use this fame as a way to build these contracts with governments. And that's a lot of why he got the contracts, was because he was well respected. Hughes Aircraft Company was not a very well run company, and it didn't have the manufacturing scale of like Lockheed or Boeing or something like that. And so Bell Helicopters. And so he kind of struggled to keep up, but his name gave him a lot of clout with these military contractors, and he knew how to wine and dine them. He knew how to do PR. Well, you know, part of this fame had come from a couple of things. First of all, he set a land speed record flying over a field, and that's when he crashed one of the planes, was during setting this land speed record. He got up to like, I think it was 341 or 342 miles per hour. And the previous record had been under 300. And so he kind of shattered that airspeed record in a plane he designed himself. It was called the H1 Racer, a plane that he built and designed. And then he also set a world record in 1938 by completing a trip around the world. Guess how long it takes to fly around the world in 1938?
Probably like 35 hours or something like that.
Oh, let me tell you what the previous record was. The previous record was 186 hours, 7 days, 18 hours, set by Wiley Post.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Wiley Post. No, I don't have any idea.
He did 91 hours, which was 3 days and 19 minutes. So he took off from New York, went to Paris. From Paris, he went to Russia. From Russia, he went to Alaska. From Alaska, he went to, I think, Minnesota. And then Minnesota back to New York. No, he had a flight crew with him.
All right. And this is you're stopping for fuel, but then you have to get up. You can't stay the night, probably, right?
Correct. They stopped and refueled and were always in a big hurry. As a matter of fact, he kind of could have had a better time, except on a couple of the stops, they had so many mobs of people around. Because this is big news in 1938. Oh, yeah. Many people around that he couldn't necessarily even take off safely. You know, they had to like move people out of the way and stuff like that. But he did that with a crew of four people in a Lockheed 14 Super Electra aircraft. And he was world famous after that. As a matter of fact, in 1938, he came back to Houston. Last time he came to Houston. And he received awards. And in 1938, they renamed the William P. Hobby Airport to the Hughes Airport.
I was going to say, I didn't know about that because it's still Hobby Airport.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was briefly Hughes Airport. And then...
Interesting.
So President Truman gave him a medal, you know, after all this happened. He got to be really famous as far as his, his flying and kind of being, one of the American daredevils and pioneers. I mean, if you think about it, if you didn't know about the drugs, you didn't know about the weird habits, you know, the peeing in a jar and the not wearing clothes and all these things weren't really happening yet during his aviation days. But if you didn't know any of that about him, you just heard this guy who set lands or airspeed records and flew around the world in the fastest time and dated starlets and was a millionaire many times over and bought businesses and made movies, you'd think this guy was just a rock star, right?
Yeah. I mean, he reminds me, little portions of that remind me of a lot of the billionaires we have today. You know, I mean, I think if you ask Jeff Bezos why he put himself in the rocket ship, he'd say, because I'm not paying all that money to have. He would probably say almost verbatim, yeah. Say the same thing.
Yeah.
Now, Elon Musk would probably say the opposite. Like, I'm not going to put myself at risk.
Let those guys test.
Notice he didn't put himself in his rocket ship. So there's different ways to look at it. But it is funny how being a super rich person, those tendencies were the same then as they are 100 years later. Just get to do whatever you want. Just have a good time. Play with your toys. Date all the starlets. It's interesting.
So again, he had these contracts with the government. The XF-11, the plane that he crashed into the side of the house in Hollywood, that actually was a partly influenced by Colonel Elliot Roosevelt, the son of the president at the time. It always comes back to the Roosevelts, doesn't it?
Always. Minor characters in our little story here, but always characters.
Elliot Roosevelt was influenced by Hughes to give this contract to buy 100 of these XF-11 aircraft. They were going to turn them into reconnaissance planes. They needed planes, three-seat aircraft with two motors and had the ability to take pictures of enemies and land and stuff like that. Well, all of that said, it never happened because they never got enough of them built to cover the war. But at the same time, there was another contract. So you're familiar with the U-boats in World War II, right? Germany's U-boats. Yeah. So these submarines were sitting off the coast, the east coast of the United States, and they were sinking freighters, sinking our cargo ships, not military ships, but sinking our ships that were taking supplies across to Europe, to our troops over there, to our allies over there. And these sinkings of by U-boats became more and more common. I mean, to the point where they were starting to sink 20, 30, 40 boats in a single month, which was not a good thing for the war effort. So someone, it wasn't Hughes, but it was immediately introduced to him, thought about the idea of, well, what if we could fly all of these supplies over to Europe? And they awarded Howard Hughes a contract to build what was called the H-4 Hercules. This was going to be what they called a flying boat. And it was supposed to be big enough to carry, I think, 700 or 800 troops, along with several tanks and large military equipment. Well, there was a weird thing going on, because at the time, there was not enough steel and aluminum and metal because of the war effort. There was a shortage of these things. So Hughes had built one of his racing planes out of wood and had this technique for doing it, for getting it all together. He built the H-4 Hercules completely out of wood, which was a completely weird thing.
Now you're talking about the spruce goose.
Oh, no. He hated that term. He hated that.
This is the plane you're talking about, right?
Yes. Yes, that is. It later became known as the spruce goose. There were a lot of derogatory names for it. And that was a name that was given because people, you know, thought it was like a big waste of money. Well, he was contracted to build three of these things, and he wasn't able to get three of them built. They had, you know, budget overages, just like normal, problems with production, problems with manufacturing, problems getting supplies. And he ended up not delivering any of them. And by the way, the spruce goose was made of birch, not spruce. So they ended up not being able to deliver any of them. And because of this, there was actually a congressional hearing about all the money that was wasted. That, you know, people were mad. Why did Howard Hughes get all this money and not even deliver anything? So he went before this board, you know, congressional board, to be questioned. And during the questioning, he actually was kind of glib and flippant. And they said, well, this thing will never fly. And he said, yes, it will. He was able to get them after the war, when the whole project was scrapped, he was able to get them to go ahead and pay to finish building one, because the first one wasn't completely built yet. So he was able to get the government to spend another, you know, they were already into it for millions of dollars. So they said, all right, if we spend another little bit comparatively, we can finish building this thing. And he kind of positioned it as learning about aviation, pushing aviation forward, right? Because nothing like this had ever been built. This was the largest airplane ever made with mm-hmm. the widest wingspan. The wingspan was further than a football field, more than 300 mm-hmm. feet across. I mean, imagine this thing sitting on the UT football field and the wings go all the way from end zone to end zone, past, right? 8 stories tall, the sitting on the ground, it was 8 stories tall. You know, it was huge. And actually, the wings were thick enough that you could stand up. People could walk around inside the wings. They were that thick. He ended up getting the money to finish building it, and he was supposed to do some taxi tests out in what was that harbor in California? Anyway,
Long Beach.
Long Beach. Thank you. In the coast, in the water at Long Beach, he was going to do some taxi tests, and the press was there. He had like 20 or 30 press members on the plane, and he just went ahead and took off and, you know, kind of said, hey, it does fly. Look at that. You know, it was his way of kind of waving his finger back at this congressional hearing to say, I did build you a plane that flies. I didn't get all three of them done. You know, there were lots of problems, but I built a plane that flies. Only time that plane ever flew.
So I visited the Spruce Goose.
And the Queen Mary?
And the Queen Mary in Long Beach.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever been to that? Have you ever seen that?
I did.
Yeah, it's. I was probably too young to appreciate it. I was probably like 14 or something when I went.
I think it was right around the same time for me. And I remember just thinking, that thing is big.
Yeah, I didn't even really process that it was an airplane and it shouldn't be that big. probably until now, the way you're describing it. But I remember going and visiting it. And it's interesting that you say he didn't like that term. That's all I knew about Howard Hughes back then, was the Spruce Goose.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of his most famous things. But again, he called it the Hercules. That was the name he wanted. H4 Hercules. It was very much a lot of people said that his problem was he didn't treat these things like businesses. He treated them like hobbies. And because he had enough money, from the Hughes Tool Company, he could kind of treat them like hobbies.
Yeah. And again, you see that today with billionaires, you know,
that the Hercules, the Spruce Goose, was actually moved to McMinnville, Oregon, where there's a Air and Space Museum, Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum.
Oh, it's not in Long Beach anymore. Oregon.
No, it's not. They moved it in 2020. There was a lot of talk about actually cutting it up and using the parts or using the lumber, or cutting it up and putting parts of it into different museums. The problem was there wasn't a big enough place to hold it, right? You couldn't put it in the Smithsonian. It was too big to go in there.
Right.
And it had to be in a temperature controlled, humidity controlled place. As a matter of fact, for a long time before it was put in that dome in Long Beach alongside the Queen Mary, and Long Beach bought it for tourism, before it was put in that dome, it had been in a climate controlled structure that the Hughes Tool Company paid for, or the Hughes Aviation, one of them paid for, over $1 million a year. And it just sat there. Nobody was looking at it. It wasn't doing anything. He just wouldn't let it go. He didn't want it destroyed. He didn't want it cut up. And interesting too, it wasn't even owned by him. It was owned by the government. They had paid him for it. And so he didn't own it, but he didn't want to let it get it. He leased it from the government for $1 a year or something like that, with the understanding that he would take the cost of keeping it from falling apart.
And I'm guessing he couldn't, that it wasn't even on display until after he died.
I don't know, because he died in 76. And yeah, I guess I was six in 76. So yeah, it's probably right. I don't know when it went to, I don't know when it ended up going to the Long Beach facility.
I went there in like 84, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say it was around that same time for me, 84, 85, something like that. But yeah, it probably was after he died that it was put on display. He also, I'm going to go quickly through this, but he also was very involved in airlines. Like, he really wanted to either be an aircraft manufacturer or an airline, run an airline. Those were kind of two things he really had passion about. Did you know that he was the primary shareholder and kind of chief by default because of his shares of TWA?
No, I didn't know that.
Basically, because he had so many shares, he was the primary shareholder. He could bully the CEO or the presidents, the executives. Like, he was able to basically tell them what he wanted done. He was able to get them hired and fired. And it didn't really make for a very healthy airline. TWA struggled. He ran into a lot of issues with promising to buy jets. This was around the time when the fleet of airplanes was converting over from prop airplanes into jet airplanes. He made a lot of promises, and he really kind of ended up getting TWA in a lot of financial trouble because they didn't have good leadership, because he was always undermining them. And he promised a lot of money to buy jets that TWA didn't have. As a matter of fact, he ended up taking the money out of Hughes Tool Company to pay for the jets. And he ended up getting ousted by TWA. The board of directors, I think, was able to do a hostile takeover of his shares. But what's interesting is they wanted to get rid of him for a number of years, like 1963, 1962, 1964. They were trying to get Hughes out of TWA, but he held on to the shares stubbornly, kept doing bad things. And then finally, in 1966, he was forced to sell the shares. And because of the timing, pure dumb luck, when he bought them, they were fairly low. He ended up making $546 million on those shares.
Jeez.
Yes. And had he sold them earlier, had he sold them, you know, at first, he wouldn't have made all that money. So he basically messed around with the TW Airlines for a long time, did a lot of bad stuff to undermine them and make them unsuccessful, drove the prices way down, had a bunch of shares, and then was told to shut up, step away, stop being that way. And he did for a couple of years. And then when they finally forced him to sell, the share prices had gone way up. And he made half a billion dollars.
You wonder what kind of person he would have been without the money. Because clearly everything that he did had to do with him having money. Every decision he made, kind of the recklessness, the flying without a net, really, basically, right?
Yeah.
In his whole life, didn't have to ever have a backup plan, could overspend for things. That kind of the money kind of shaped who he was. But he was probably also, you know, he had good ideas, maybe. And he was, you know, he's an interesting person. I wonder without the money if he would have been as interesting.
He got to the point where he had a staff. I think I said this earlier. He had a staff of people that they would call, and he didn't take the calls directly. It would go to his staff, and then they would decide what was worth him listening to. Or if it was important, they would take a message and he would call the person back. They never like, even the president and people like that couldn't get him on the phone. He had to make the call to them, you know? Wow. And so he got more and more isolated and insulated. And that was kind of the part of the problem. So, and this was really, you know, it started when he was in California and at the Beverly Hills Hotel, like living in those bungalows. Kind of that's where he started to be a little bit weird and isolated. Eventually, he moved to Las Vegas. And the reason he moved was taxes. Las Vegas doesn't have state income tax. He didn't want to pay it. And he had been at odds with the California government for so long. He was like, I'm out of here. Went to Las Vegas. He was staying in the Desert Inn, which was at the time one of the most luxurious, and, you know, all the stars, the Brat Pack, the Frank Sinatras, and the, you know, those type of people all went to the Desert Inn because it was really the place to be seen. And he had bought up the entire top floor. Like he was renting it. Well, they actually wanted to kick him out. Can you imagine why?
Because he wasn't hygienic, or you said he wasn't showering.
No, he wasn't gambling.
Oh, okay. Not because of the jars of piss that he had everywhere.
That, you know, as long as he was paying his bill, that probably didn't matter. But if you think about it, first of all, most of his staff was Mormon. He had a guy named William Gay, who was his kind of chief of staff for many, many years. And William Gay, Bill Gay, was a Mormon and recruited other Mormons to be on the staff. And he felt he could trust Mormons. William Gay did, and so did Hughes. And so these people didn't gamble. They didn't drink. And so to have an entire floor of a hotel taken up by people that aren't gambling or drinking or doing anything like that kind of hurts your revenue. So that's why they wanted to kick him out.
That's
so
funny.
Guess what Hughes did? He bought the hotel. He basically said, all right, fine, I'll buy the hotel. He bought the hotel, and he liked the idea of owning real estate in Nevada. He bought other hotels. He bought other casinos. He bought television station, the local Las Vegas TV station. He bought mineral and mining rights all around Las Vegas. And he eventually owned the Sands, the Frontier, the Silver Slipper, Castaways, the Landmark, Herald's Club in Reno. He became the biggest employer in all of Nevada.
Wow.
And during that time, though, he ran into a lot of problems because he owned such a high percentage of the hotels. And I'm fast forwarding through several years here.
Sure.
While he was in Las Vegas, he ended up buying so many that he ended up under scrutiny for antitrust.
Antitrust.
For having a monopoly, like, wow, having too many. And there were a lot of people in Vegas and Nevada that were big fans. He was really close with the governor. He was close with the newspapermen there who ran positive stories on him. But yeah, he was investigated for antitrust. He kept his aides and his advisors and his lawyers kept saying, okay, don't buy any more casinos on the strip because you already own 50% of them and you're going to be hit by, you know, the government's going to look into you and not going to approve your gambling licenses because you have to have a license to run a gambling establishment. He didn't care. He just kept doing it and he kept finding ways around it, kept getting it approved. He greased the right palms, gave bribes to the right people, and ended up being the biggest employer of people in Nevada.
Wow. What a complicated dude.
And there's a few more things. I know we're a little over time, but he also started the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Some people say, now have you heard of this charity?
No.
Some people say he started it because his parents had died at a young age and he wanted to do research into heart attacks and health and stuff like that. But what it really ended up being was this complicated scheme where he was able to start a nonprofit and then put all of the shares of the Hughes Aircraft Company under the medical institute or medical foundation and basically tax shelter everything. And then he made himself the only board of director, the only board member or director of the nonprofit. And it was just a big scheme. He put less than 0.1%, 0.1% into the medical research he said he was going to do. And the rest of it was just money going into this Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and which was supposed to be a tax exempt charity, and was able to pay himself. He did loans to the institute that he got paid back with interest, and it was a big boondoggle that he did. I don't know if that institute is still around today. I didn't get a chance to look that up, but it was something that apparently a lot of companies were doing that because there wasn't a lot of oversight into nonprofits at the time, and it was not an uncommon business practice. But the government eventually kind of started cracking down on it because they were losing a lot in taxes.
I think you continue to show us that rich and powerful people, from Henry the Eighth to Howard Hughes, are just weird.
Yes.
Because there's no one there to say no, and there's no everyone says your ideas all get implemented, you know?
Well, that was the thing, was this staff he had, they didn't say no. They allowed him to take a lot of narcotics over his years. And, you know, they ended up having to sell the Hughes Tool Company, his moneymaker, the one thing that made money. And that kind of is around the time he lost control. Now, when they sold the Hughes Tool Company, they ended up reincorporating it as a public company called Summa. And you're probably familiar with the term summa cum laude.
Yeah.
So it meant kind of top. He hated the name. He hated the whole idea of it. He wanted to call it HRH Properties because of all the property they owned, which he thought stood for Hughes Resort Hotels. That was his idea for it. But Summa was a money loser for a long time as well. But there were actually a couple of companies, one in particular. His aircraft company ended up becoming a very big moneymaker because even though, you know, the Spruce Goose was a failure and the other military planes were failures, they kept these military contracts. And I guess once you're in with the military, you're able to stay in with the military. Well, sure. They ended up with converting the name to Hughes Technologies. Have you heard of HughesNet? It's a big internet provider. Yeah, that's from them.
They do the satellite that's right. internet.
As a matter of fact, they were the ones that launched the Early Bird satellite in 1965. First communication satellite was launched by Hughes in 1965. Obviously, you know, there was a big impact on aviation because like the Navy's F-14 Tomcat has weapons control systems made by Hughes. The Air Force F-4 has missiles and fire control made by Hughes. The Army's anti-tank missiles are made by Hughes. They have, of course, Hughes Net is cable and internet over satellites, like you said. They make in-flight entertainment systems. They make testing equipments. They make lasers. They even make things that went in, remember the digital watches before the Apple Watch? Mm. Like some of the key equipment. So the company ended up actually doing pretty well, but that was kind of after he quit running it. That was the key. As soon as he stopped running something, it would end up doing okay. Hmm. He ended up, you know, in his reclusive time, like I said, he didn't shave, he had these really long, gross fingernails and toenails supposedly. And he would have them clipped every so often. He was only 90 pounds and he had stood at 6'3". He didn't eat very much. He just sat in his room, took codeine, took Valium, and watched movie reels that his staff would queue up for him. Wow. And yeah, this wasn't even like VCR. This was like 1966 to 1970. It's said that he took over 33,000 codeine tablets.
Oh my gosh.
In his years. Now, narcotics will give you constipation pretty badly. So he had to have an enema like pretty often, and his staff had to do that. Mm. But while he was living in Las Vegas, after, I'm not exactly sure why, he ended up moving to Nicaragua. He lived for a little while in Vancouver. He lived for a little while in... Oh, you know what this was? This had to do with tax evasion. Like he was under investigation for tax evasion. So he ended up leaving the country, going to Vancouver, going to Nicaragua. There was a big earthquake. So he moved to Mexico and the Bahamas. And he ended up getting to a really bad place in Mexico where they thought he was going to die. So they got him on a plane coming back to Texas, and he did die on that plane on the way back to Houston. They say they had crossed the Rio Grande, that he died in Texas officially, but it's not really known. But what is known is when they brought him into the, I think it was Methodist Hospital in Houston, they found out he had kidney failure. But they also found out that he had been injected with painkillers while he was passed out on the plane, and that might have been what killed him, put him over the edge. Nobody ever really investigated who did the injection or what was done for. He had four doctors on his staff, but he was malnutritioned. He was covered in bed sores. He had he had been using glass syringes with metal needles. And when he had X-rays done after he died, they found five broken off needles in his arm that been broken off and were still there. That, you know,
like they said, used to. Too many yes men. You know what would be one way to get me to stop being a yes man, though?
What's that?
If you asked me to give you an enema.
Yeah, there
That's
was.
That's right. Well, here's saying no, Kelly.
You know. Funny enough, the guy who gave him the enema, one of his chiefs of staff was named John Holmes. He had Bill Gay, John Holmes, and another guy named Woodcock on his staff. So, all good Mormon guys. Yeah, I mean, I could honestly go on for another hour because there's a whole thing about a fake autobiography that somebody claimed he had authorized but actually wasn't authorized, and there was a whole thing with that. There was a whole thing with his estate and a guy that supposedly saved his life who was put into his will at the end of his life. And by the way, funny thing, when he was 19, when his parents died, he actually redid his will, and that was when he came up with the idea for this medical nonprofit, you know, to do medical research. But that will got superseded by another will later in life that he worked on for years and years and years and never finished and never signed. So nobody actually knew if he had a will or not. So when he died, this strange man showed up, and they called this the Mormon will. And because it had to do with the Mormon church, and it had to do with like money going to his ex-wives, to his first cousin. The whole thing was a mess. Like the whole
thing. I think they made a movie about that called Melvin and Howard. Was that Melvin and Howard?
Yes. Yeah, yes, you're right. Yeah, Melvin Dumar is the guy that supposedly saved his life. And there was a movie made about it. And that segues nicely into sort of pop culture. There was a movie called The Carpetbaggers that was basically loosely based on him. There was, James Bond, Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah.
Or you've heard of it?
Yeah.
1971, it featured a tall, reclusive billionaire Texan named Willard White, who was played by James Dean, who operates his business empire from the penthouse of a Las Vegas hotel. Tell me who that is. Mm-hmm. There was an episode in 1973 of The Partridge Family called Diary of a Mad Millionaire. And that was a reference to, like, the character was based on Howard Hughes. There was The Amazing Howard Hughes, based on a book written by one of his lieutenants, Noah Dietrich, who he later had a falling out with. Melvin and Howard, 1980. The film Creepshow had a episode that had to do with a character based on him. The Rocketeer had a episode that had to do with Howard Hughes. Conspiracy Theory. The Aviator, which I actually watched, with directed by Martin Scorsese and with Leonardo DiCaprio. Have you seen that
one? Love that movie. Yeah, it came. In fact, as you were talking throughout this episode, it was reminding me of stories from that movie. Great movie. Came out like 20 years ago, though, right?
2004. Exactly 20 years ago. Remember the animated movie Robots?
Oh, yeah.
It was kind of around the time of Pixar. I don't know if it was Pixar or not.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but yeah.
Yeah, it was, you know, one of these like cars and planes, and there were all these movies that came out about things. Well, there was a character named Mr. Bigweld that Mel Brooks voiced, and he was the owner and inventor of Bigweld Industries, and that was sort of based on Howard Hughes. Stan Lee said that Tony Stark was inspired by Howard Hughes. And then there's a ton of songs that reference Howard Hughes, one by Genesis, one by Jim Croce, one by the band 10cc, the Boomtown Rats, Kansas, AC/DC. I mean, these all have references to Howard Hughes.
It's definitely made a mark, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty amazing how many songs.
Do you think most of those songs and most of those pop culture references have to do with him being a weird recluse or being a rich Texan?
I think it's mostly weird recluse. Cause the songs are like, Working at the Car Wash Blues is one of them. There's Howard Hughes in blue suede shoes, smiling at the majorettes, smoking Winston cigarettes. Some of the lyrics. That's the Genesis song called Broadway Melody of 1974.
Yeah. Kind of people gravitate towards him being a weirdo.
And then, you know, some of my favorites here, he had a character based on him on The Greatest American Hero, if you remember that show. Of course, the Beverly Hillbillies, the Clampett Hughes Empire, where Jed Clampett, while in Hooterville, decided to merge his interests with a man Mr. Drysdale believes is Howard Hughes, the famous but reclusive billionaire. Eventually, it turns out, to Mr. Drysdale's chagrin, that Hughes is no billionaire. He's an old farmer named Howard Hughes, spelled H-E-W-E-S.
Yeah, I remember that episode, actually.
You do?
Yeah.
I am Howard Hughes.
Because that's the crossover with Green Acres.
Ah, okay, okay. Green Acres is a place for me.
You don't want to get me started on 60 sitcoms. We'll be here all day.
Phineas and Ferb had one where they set out to build a plane bigger than the Spruce Goose, if you remember Phineas and Ferb. And, of course, the classic of all times, The Simpsons, had an episode where basically Mr. Burns was styled to be Howard Hughes, and they renamed the plane from Spruce Goose to Spruce Moose.
And also 90 pounds, 6'2", 90 pounds, I think.
Yeah, with bed sores and naked a lot of the time. So yeah, he was buried next to his parents in Glenwood Cemetery in Houston. I'd actually like to go check out his tombstone sometime.
Let's do it.
Red Brick House, where he lived as a teenager, is at 3921 Yoakum Boulevard. It is still there, and it's on the grounds of the University of St. Thomas.
So if we left a Dirt Nap City sticker on that gravesite, would that be inappropriate?
That'd be rock and roll.
Would that be something that he would do?
He'd have his people do it.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is you need to get your wife's sister's kids to go do that for us, because they're fans, right?
Sure. And I remember you suggesting, we saw a picture of Shackleton's gravesite.
Yeah, that's right. With your parents or your parents' friends.
Yeah, we should put a Dirt Nap City sticker on that gravesite. So maybe that's what we'll do in 2024. We'll start putting Dirt Nap City stickers on various gravesites. And if you take a picture of one, we'll send you a little something special.
And that's going to be a sign of respect, not vandalism.
Absolutely.
Officially. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, we're doing this out of respect, not out of disrespect.
But also, we didn't do it. If
yeah, if you see one,
we didn't do it. Our fans did it.
I didn't even mention the fact that he was tied to Watergate. And he was, there's so many things. So many things. I seriously could have done another hour. So sorry for going so long. But Howard Hughes, ladies and gentlemen.
Nice job, Kelly. Thanks for letting me know about Howard Hughes.
You're welcome.